Okay, so today I want to talk about divisors and line bundles. Oh yeah, and also one more bookkeeping thing by the way before we start. I'm sorry the times keep changing like this, but it's some people giving seminars that I want to attend. So Wednesday's lecture, which I think I told you was going to be from I think I said it was 1:30 to 3. Well, I found out the number theory seminar in the maths department is at, starts at 2, which is, I didn't realize that. So that conflicts with that. So to avoid that conflict, we're going to have this meeting from 9 to 11. I hope that won't be too inconvenient. those who are coming from out of town, the plan is to post the notes. So either physically or electronically, so one way or the other you'll get the notes. Okay. So as I said, I want to talk today about divisors and line bundles, and And what we will see by the end of the class is information about the map on an abelian variety which is given by multiplication by n. So maybe I say this as a remark, as motivation, partly as motivation, but on an elliptic curve, so you think of that either, that is abelian variety of dimension 1, we have the map multiplication by n, so elliptic curve E, let's say, to E. It takes a point P and sends it to n times P. In other words, P plus P n times. By the way, I'm assuming everybody is familiar with elliptic curves. Is that okay? Or do you want me to say a few back words of background about elliptic curves? No response means you don't want the background. Okay, that's fine. And because it's a curve, it's usually you choose an equation that defines the curve, and then you you figure out this morphism, multiplication by n. So one of the most important things to study about this is the kernel of n. Here, by the way, n is some integer. We might as well assume it's bigger than or equal to 1. The kernel of n, so in other words, these are points P on E over K bar, whatever the K field K is. So let's say E is defined over K. K bar, such that n times P is 0. This is an extremely important group. This is a finite abelian group. And if P doesn't divide the characteristic of K, for example, if K is a field of characteristic 0, then this kernel of N as abelian group is isomorphic to Z mod nZ squared. This isomorphism is as abelian groups. But the way you prove this, this is proved by using the explicit equation of the curve and the explicit formula that defines the map. P goes to NP. And in turn, that latter thing, in turn, this depends on an explicit addition law. Right? So anybody who's worked with points of order n on an elliptic curve knows that how you get at them is that the addition law is completely explicit. If I give you the x and y coordinates of the points I want to add, I can produce the rational function that gives you the sum, right? And then you say, okay, if I ever reiterate that, what would I get? You can't do it explicitly, but completely explicitly, but you'll say I get a polynomial of degree n squared, and so generically it should have n squared zeros. That's how this is proved. Now we have a problem if we want to study that kind of question on, I think Kaninik has not signed it. That kind of question in the higher dimensional case, we have a problem because we don't have the equations given, we don't have the addition law given explicitly, and yet we still want to understand this finite group, in fact this finite group scheme. And so we have to develop some other technique rather than depending on the equation of the variety or the equations of the variety and the explicit group law. Need a substitute to compensate for the lack of explicit defining of equations. Now, at some point, computational people amongst you will say, well, look, now or later, I need explicit equations if I'm going to write some computer code to do the calculation. And the hope is you will get such equations eventually. But the question is, equations for what? As I told you before, the work of Mumford shows that if I take a general abelian variety and try to write equations for it, I'll get a horrendous set of equations in huge numbers of variables. And so there, computationally, this just will be impractical. So my point is to try to see whether there's something else that can be more compactly defined on which we can do explicit arithmetic. So I grant you that eventually we do need explicit equations. But maybe it's not for the abelian variety that we should be looking for. Okay, so the tool that we're going to use as a substitute is the tool of line bundles. It will help us. And you will see by the end of the class today, we will have information about the kernel of multiplication by n, not complete information yet, but beginning information on the kernel of multiplication by n without having recourse to equations. Okay, so let's start talking about divisors and line bundles then. So I have x certainly non-singular and complete algebraic variety. Maybe I may even need to assume that it is projective. This is very interesting. Okay. Let it stabilize. Pardon? Oh, officially it's broken. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so what we're going to first define a divisor, I take a codimension 1 subvariety which we'll call, which is another name for that, we call it the hypersurface. By some abuse of terminology. And an example, if you want to think of this, why we call it a hypersurface, is if X is projective space, so projective space, as you know, is given by homogeneous coordinates x0 to xn, xi in some field, xi. And this square bracket with this thing means that I'm looking at ordinary n plus 1 tuples modulo scalar multiplication. Right? Modulo equivalence where x0 to xn is equivalent to y0 to yn if there exists lambda such that yi equals lambda xi for all I. So this is up to scalar. So we discussed this last time. And I can consider, for example, I can set for any I, I can consider the x in Pn with the property that xi equals 0. So that will denote hi, and this is a hypersurface. And actually, you can see it's essentially Pn minus 1. By setting the i-th coordinate to be 0. More generally, if I take some, if f is some homogeneous polynomial in n plus 1 variables, then f equals 0 defines a hypersurface. In other words, some subvariety of codimension 1. Codimension means the complement of dimension. So if y is sitting inside x, that means to have y be of codimension 1 means dimension of y is dimension of x minus 1. Okay? So dimension of y equals dimension of x minus 1. Or maybe another way of saying it, codimension in x of y is dimension of x minus dimension of y. Okay. So in general, we don't have a global equation defining a codimension 1 variety, but locally we do. So in the neighborhood of any point, y will be defined by a single equation. So such as f equals 0. But the point is you may not be able to use one function that works globally. And moreover, let's say by single equation, say f equals 0, of course f depends on y. Moreover, if g is a function that vanishes at y, then g is divisible by f. So here is here is y, and I'm taking a point, little y, and I'm saying in the neighborhood of a point, you can define y, actually y is sitting inside the ambient space x, so here's x, this is y, and in the neighborhood of a point, so here is y, I take a neighborhood of y in x, and then the points in y can be defined, can be distinguished, the elements of this neighborhood that belong to y can be distinguished by the vanishing of some function. Okay, but the function depends on the y and essentially the choice of neighborhood. But the point is there is some invariance, namely that if you have any function on x that vanishes here, then locally it's got to vanish at nearby points as well. And so in fact it's a multiple of f. Another way of saying that is that the local ring at that point is a discrete valuation ring. And so the valuation is given by the power of f that divides g. Okay. This thing, by the way, about if it vanishes locally, it's got to be, if it vanishes at a point, it's got to vanish at nearby points of y, is, you know this from complex analysis, this is just a basic fact about power series, Laurent series. Okay, so now a divisor D on x is a formal, since I'm assuming I have something complete, I can assume it's a form of finite sum MIYI, where MIs are integers and YIs are irreducible co-dimension 1 subvarieties, so irreducible hypersurfaces. So in the case of in the case that we have a curve example, if x is a curve, this is what you're all familiar with. This is a curve. Then a divisor is a formal sum of points. Co-dimension 1 means it's dimension 0. Dimension 0 and irreducible means it's a point. Okay, so in the case of curves, this is what traditionally people work with. And in general case, you have some linear combination of co-dimension 1 subvarieties. So co-dimension 1 plays the role of point. And in fact, that's going to be a theme in our discussion. Replace points with co-dimension 1 varieties, in other words, divisors. D definition. D is effective or positive if all MIs are bigger than or equal to zero. It's effective because there's actually a, if you like, a subscheme inside X corresponding to those YIs, namely the union of the YIs. In other words, there's something geometric there. On the other hand, if some of the MIs are negative, let's say we have y1 minus y2, there's nothing geometric corresponding to that. You don't have minus of a subvariety. It's not a geometric thing, but it's an algebraic thing. Okay. Now, as I said, if this point here, let me just say again that if you have a function on x, so if g is a function on x, in other words, g is an element of the function field of x, rational function field of x, then near a point y in y, that is in a neighborhood of a point y in y, g looks like f to some power times h, where h doesn't vanish. There is an integer a such that this happens. And once again, the reason, it's not the reason, it's the another way of saying it, is that the local ring at y is a discrete valuation ring. And so therefore, any g, I can restrict it to a neighborhood, any neighborhood of y, and therefore I get an element in the local ring, and then I apply the valuation. So that valuation is telling me the order, the power of f that divides it. Okay, so because of this, then we can define a principal divisor. We can define, therefore, we can define the divisor of a function to be notation like this, and it's the sum over irreducible hypersurfaces, and then, so this is summing over irreducible hypersurfaces of x, and then I talk about the order along V of G times V. And if G is not 0, not 0, then only finitely many hypersurfaces will contribute here. That basically you prove by a compactness argument. Has a finite number of terms. First you restrict to an open affine, and then you show in a fixed, so you reduce to the affine case, and then you show that G can only vanish along a finite number of reducible hypersurfaces. This is the kind of thing, by the way, yeah. Yes, because so does F. See, F is the equation defining the hypersurface near the point Y. Yeah. I think I said that somewhere, I hope. Yeah. It depends, it's not a global thing. Sometimes it is a global, there is a global equation, as I showed in the projector space case, but in general it's not, it depends on the point. But, yeah. Yeah, so therefore the point is by connectedness, a component passing, it only depends not on the specific point y, but on an irreducible component that passes through y. That's the remark I made here, that if something vanishes at y, it vanishes on nearby points, and nearby means it vanishes on an entire irreducible component. At first, these look a little surprising, but really they're just statements about polynomials. All of these are statements about polynomials. And I was just about to make the remark, which is I'm glad you raised the question, that this is the kind of thing I might ask the students who are taking the course to write out the details of, because it's not hard to do, but it's a good exercise. So you missed what I said at the beginning, is the students that are registered in the course, I'll give you some exercises to do, and that way you can be evaluated. Okay, but anyway, it is a finite sum. Okay. Next is linear equivalence. So there's an equivalence relation on these divisors, which is the same relation as you know from curves. Namely, you say that two divisors are linearly equivalent. So this is linear equivalence. If their difference is the divisor of a function. So these, are, by the way, are called, did I call it principal divisors? This is such a divisor is called a principal divisor. And the divisor class group is divisors modulo linear equivalence. Okay, there's an alternative way to define divisors, which actually is a different way if for a general scheme, but in the case of a smooth variety, it's just an alternate way. Okay, alternate description. So I can define a divisor in terms of what it's doing locally. So I take a cover, UI, open cover, an open cover of X, and on each UI, we'll define a function F, a rational function. On UI, and we want some compatibility that fi, so I want to know, so here is UI and here is UJ, so on the overlap I have a fi and fj on the overlap, so on UI intersected UJ we want that fi over fj is non-vanishing and regular. In other words, it has neither zero nor pole. It's a unit on the overlap. So that's another way of saying that the order of vanishing of fi and the order of vanishing on fj agree on the overlap. You see, here I have in the old way, the hypersurface here is defined by fi equals 0. And here it's defined by fj equals 0. So I want to make sure that on the overlap, they're defining something consistent. Okay, so the quotient is neither vanishing nor does it have a pole. Okay, if you have such a thing, then you clearly what we had here gives rise to such a thing. But alternatively, you could start your definition in this way. So this, in this case, if you have this thing, then a divisor is then the collection. So you have a divisor in this description, then is an open cover together with a function on each set in the open cover, such that there is some consistency in the overlap in this way. Not that the two functions are the same, but the order of vanishing is the same. And in this setting, then a principal divisor in this setting then means that I have a function. So if there is a function f on x, such that f restricted to each ui is fi, or actually I guess more I can allow not exact equality, but this divided by fi is non-zero and regular. So if I can piece together these fi's that I'm given locally into some global function, not on the nose, but up to something non-zero and regular, then you have a principal divisor. Okay. We're going a little slowly, I guess. In the literature, by the way, this is called a Cartier divisor, this description of a divisor. And the first one I gave you is called a Weil divisor. And as I said, in the non-singular case, they're the same. Next, I want to remind you, or inform you, as the case might be, of sheaves. So this a sheaf on a, suppose I have a topological, so this is now a general, quite a general construction. Suppose I have a topological space X. At this stage, we don't need to even assume algebraic structure, topological space. So I'm going to define a sheaf of abelian groups. It's a map that associates to each open set in X some, let's give this name, sheaf F of abelian groups, some abelian group. At any time, by the way, you can stop me and say, I already know this, go on to the next topic. I'll happily go to the next topic. Pardon? So you help them. You take the lead then. You want me to skip it?
No.
So sheaves of abelian groups are things, you see, when you have when you have local descriptions and you're trying to construct some global way of piecing all the local information together, that's when sheaves are very useful. And the reason I'm introducing them is because in the algebraic category, the best way to talk about line bundles is locally free sheaves of rank one. Okay, so I have the concept. It's an abstract concept, as you can see. It works on any topological space. I can put other structure on the values. I just chose a billion groups. You can make them rings, you can make them modules for a fixed ring, whatever you like. And the point is, they have to satisfy some compatibility though. They have to satisfy, so satisfying the following properties. If I have a subset V in U, which is also open, these are both open, then I want to be able to restrict these things down to V. So restriction. Think of these as groups of functions. See, I have a function defined on U. I don't have necessarily a global function. I have all these functions defined in neighborhoods of points. So I want to be able to restrict from a bigger set to a smaller set. And on the other hand, in some cases, I want to be able to go the other way. If I have a bunch of open sets, and I have a function here, and I have a function here, and I have a function here, I want to be able to say if they agree on the overlap, then I have a function on the union. I want to be able to put things together from smaller sets to bigger sets. So I need to say that if U is the union of UIs, if UI is open, of course always open, and if I have some SI defined on each UI, and such that SI, let's see, SI on UI intersected UJ is SJ on UI intersected UJ. In other words, on the overlaps, here is SI, and or here is UI, and SI is defined here, and here is UJ, and SJ is defined here. On this overlap, they should agree. Okay, so then I can piece these SI together to get a section on U. S restricted to UI is SI for all I. I can piece them all together. These things, by the way, are called sections, and I'll explain to you later why. Elements are called sections. And F of X is called global sections. In other words, the group of elements that's associated to the whole space is called, they're called global sections. So this is what this is saying, is somehow from local sections that are compatible can be pieced together to form a global section. The word section comes from maps, which I'll show you later. And also there's a uniqueness. This S is unique. In other words, you can't have two global sections extending the local one. If they match on each UI, then there's only one way of extending it. Okay. So a simple example, if you want to keep one in mind, is, but this is not a good example, it's too simple. If you take a affine space, then you can take for each U, you can take F of U to be polynomials in K bracket x1 to xn restricted to U. So U is some open set in affine space, and you can take all polynomials and restrict them to U. It's kind of not the best example, but in fact, for an, this is essentially the only example. Maybe I'll give you one more example just to tell you that the theory is non-trivial. yeah, maybe just tell you, x is Pn. Then we have a sheaf which will denote O1. And this sheaf is essentially the one I showed you before. It's the sheaf of sheaf corresponding to a hyperplane section. This is sheaf arising from hyperplane section. I'll say more words about this O of 1 later on. Oh, analytic number theorists, beware. It's calligraphic O. Well, you see, there's the Landau notation in analytic number theory. When you estimate something, if you have a bounded amount, you write it as O of 1. Yeah, Ken. Yes, okay. Just like I did last time with varieties too. Yeah. Because I'll tell you why. In some sense, at some point we should start talking about schemes. So we shouldn't make the distinction. But anyway, for now it's okay. Okay. Here's, I guess, one more example. For any, maybe another example. For any x, we have the structure sheaf. Ox. So Ox is the sheaf which has the following property, that on any u, Ox of u is functions on u. So u is an open subset of x. These are regular functions. Not so k of x is the field of rational functions on x. But I look at the polynomial, so it's really a glorified version of this thing here. Suppose x is not affine space or projective space, suppose it's defined by some set of equations, then when I restrict polynomials to that open set, some things are just going to get wiped out, right? Because on that variety, some polynomials just disappear, they're zero. But basically I'm doing the same thing. I'm looking at the ambient space and then restricting those functions to U. But that defines a sheaf, and that's called the structure sheaf of X. Okay, so the sheaves now we're going to be interested in are very special sheaves. They're going to have, firstly, they're going to be locally free sheaves. So a sheaf is locally free, sheaf F on X is locally free that means that actually before I say that, I'm sorry, I have to say something else. Oh, it's okay. Okay, that's okay. If for all U open, F on U is a free OX of U module. So initially we had just defined sheaves of abelian groups, but suppose it has an additional structure. Suppose I require that on each U is actually a module for this structure sheaf. That's what I'm doing here. And moreover, I'm imposing an additional condition that it be a free module. So that means locally this looks like, say, some number of copies of Ox of U. And finally, we want to define an invertible sheaf. Is which I now change notation to L, is a locally free OX sheaf of rank 1. Sheaf of rank 1. Locally free sheaf of OX modules. It's locally free. Yeah. So by this OX sheaf, what I mean is that locally, it is locally an OX module, and I want it to be locally free, but then free of rank 1. So that what that means is, to put it another way, L of U is isomorphic to OX of U locally as abelian groups, or as modules, I guess. All of this, by the way, is motivated by what we know from the theory of Dedekind domains. An invertible sheaf is supposed to correspond to a fractional ideal. Sir? Yeah. You don't what? Yeah, so therefore, okay, so now you're looking at spec O, where O is, K is a number field. O is a ring of integers. Spec O is a ring. So now it falls completely outside this whole thing. It's neither an affine nor it's not a variety, it's a scheme. Okay, so now what are the points in that scheme? The maximal sub-variety, sub-schemes correspond to prime ideals, right? And now, so it's not exactly, but there is a translation to be made, because prime ideals are, it's a Dedekind domain, so prime ideals are maximal. Yeah, that's an important point. The ring of integers of a number field is a Dedekind domain, so prime ideals are maximal. So that means that divisor is now, I'm going over irreducible codimension 1 subarrays. Well, this is a dimension 1 ring. And so codimension 1 means I'm going over points, which means the prime ideals, but prime ideals are maximal. So that corresponds to, so this a divisor in the number field case, so this is a sort of an aside, but actually it's an important aside, which maybe we should go into more detail, but not necessarily now. So if K is a number field, as you all know, is a finite, that is, a finite extension of Q, finite meaning algebraic, that is algebraic extension of Q, then I have OK is the integral closure of Z in K. In other words, the elements of K, every element of K is algebraic over Q, so it satisfies some polynomial equation. But if that polynomial that it satisfies is integral, that is monic, then you say it lies in the integral closure. So OK, and this OK is a free ring, free Z module. Oh, I forgot, this is the broken one. As a Z module, it's isomorphic. It's a free Z module of rank equal to the degree of K to Q. So in other words, as a Z module, it's isomorphic to Z to the degree. Now, an ideal so prime ideals of OK are maximal. So here in the divisor, we went over irreducible co-dimension 1 subvarieties, and those correspond to, in general, they correspond to height 1 primes. But as I say, the whole ring is dimension 1, so these correspond to prime ideals. And here we have a linear combination MVV. So here we'll have some MPP, but that you should think of as the ideal product P to the MP. So this is an ideal in O. And a principal ideal is something which is generated by an element of O, but that corresponds to a principal divisor here, divisor of a function. So because what is the factorization of this thing? It's, let's say, P to the ord P of alpha. But that's exactly the divisor that you... So that's why divisor classes and ideal classes are the same. And then a sheaf is, as I said, corresponds to... You see, to get properly... it's a fractional ideal means that it's a... It's a Z-module that has a denominator. It's an OK module that has a denominator. In other words, you allow something which is not necessarily living inside OK. And the reason you want to do that is to get a group structure on the ring of ideals. So you want to make sense of P inverse. That's why you have to move away from ideals to modules. And that's what we're doing here. But it's rank one. You see, as an ideal, you see, P is locally free. All of these things are locally free. Because if I localize at a prime, then OKP is a discrete valuation ring. Okay? So everything is, so the image of P, the ideal P in here is a principle. It's generated by some pi. So locally these are principle. That's another way of saying it's locally free. And rank one because it's got one generator. That's the connection. Okay, now I think this is about the point where Alina starts to phase out. You want a break? Does anyone want a break? Okay, so let's take a break of what? 5 minutes? 10 minutes. 11:10 we'll start again. So it's not quite 10 minutes, it'll be 8 minutes. How many wish the course would go faster? They'll slow down. Yeah. Pardon?
I am
RSP. You what?
I am RSP.
Oh, I see. You wrote to me?
About my work on cryptography.
Recently?
Yes.
Okay, last few days I just looked very quickly at emails, I didn't read anything. You attached a paper, right? PDF, I didn't open it yet, sorry. Okay, are you in Toronto now?
Yes.
I see. Who do you work with?
It's been so long, but I have been interested in cryptography.
Oh, I see, okay.
And I am studying data conveyed in network.
Data conveyance in network?
Yes. My point of view is instead of studying crypto system, I want to study to associate to...
Topology, sounds interesting, yeah, right.
See if the global network can enable to attack these data.
Right.
And this may involve some algebra properties
yes.
of the network, because if the network is, for example, associated to a covering of an algebra variety, this can be
changed. Right. Yeah, no, your email was interesting. I didn't open the PDF file yet.
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. Hi.
Again, I have a request. Is it possible to hold the lecture on Wednesday a bit late because there's cool. No bus from work to come here?
Yeah, the problem is this, that in Wednesday afternoon in the maths department we have number theory seminar and colloquium. Mm-hmm. Number theory seminar is from 2 to 3 and colloquium is from 4 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, it's in, again in the morning.
Oh, like later in the morning, you
yeah,
mean?
Like 10,
12, I think yeah. the problem at the Fields Institute is that there's another course starting that's going to conflict with this
uh-huh.
time. Now, if the audience is disjoint, then we can continue.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how maybe when we start again, I'll ask how many are planning to take Dan Bernstein's high-speed cryptography
mm-hmm.
course.
Yeah. Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah, so it's conflict thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is the reason.
And then, so that can be, have the notes available.
So the problem is now. Let me see. If maybe one of these people who are taking good notes, maybe we can get them to post their notes. My own notes are evolving. You see, I typed some of it as I'm going along,
mm-hmm.
but it keeps changing. I add stuff to it.
Mm-hmm.
I have to work out a way. Either I'll get a student to post their notes, or I'll post my own notes.
Okay. Or is that a book that is
well, the books. Here's Godri. The books are kind of varied. There's Mumford's book on A Billion Varieties,
mm-hmm.
Hartshorne, Griffiths and Harris. These are the standard books, I think. You would.
Which books?
Hartshorne,
yeah.
Introduction to Algebraic Geometry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Good.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
What does locally free mean? And what does three derivation mean?
Okay, locally free means it looks like this. See, if you have a module, if I have a module over a ring, free module is something which looks like R to the N. So here is locally free means when I restrict to U, it's free. Of rank 1, so it's just one copy of this ring. Discrete valuation ring means that I have a valuation, so a valuation from a ring to some set of values like Z. I want, so firstly to be a valuation, actually it can take values in some object. Okay, and in order to be a valuation, it's got to satisfy some properties like some inequalities. But if the value set, this thing, is a discrete set, then you say it's a discrete valuation. So in this case, it's taking values in Z, which is discrete. Okay? Didn't you want to get up and walk around? No. Salut, Pierre. Pierrick or Pierre?
Pierrick.
How are you?
Fine. And you?
Fine, thanks. So you're here for a workshop or just going to
yes.
spend some time here?
I've just been 2 weeks.
Oh, very good.
1 week before the workshop and then the workshop.
Okay.
And I took your course in the world. I don't know what you are doing. But,
still basic. Still, I'm just
basic.
Talking about... and so today, by the end of today, I'll prove that multiplication by n on an abelian variety has finite kernel.
Okay.
No.
That's interesting. I
yeah.
don't know the proof.
Because we have no equations. We cannot do the analytic
yeah,
curve.
Yeah. You cannot do a
yeah.
division polynomial.
No.
No. So
you
do
so line bundles.
Line
if you use line bundles, say the degree of the map is
mm-hmm.
ampleness of line bundles, and then how does multiplication by n act on a line bundle?
And also, if n is compliant to p, then this is
the eventually, yeah, eventually we'll do that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll, next time we'll start finite group schemes.
Okay, so maybe I should attend a
chat. Heckle a little bit.
So right now you are making this line bundle?
Yeah, right now I'm telling them, it's not I'm putting people to sleep, because I don't know.
No,
it's possible everybody knows it, you know, but yet I'm going through it.
Cannot everybody
know it. Oh, well, I don't know. I know where to find it.
Yes.
But I have never read it carefully. It's always better to have a lecture than to read a book.
Depends on the lecture.
It depends on the lecture.
Okay, yes, thank you. Sorry? Oh. For all sufficiently small open? Yeah, okay. So maybe the right way to say it is, if for all points there is an open neighborhood, I just realized I was walking around with this microphone, so all this chit chat was recorded. It's not as serious as that CNN reporter that had their microphone on and went to the washroom or something and kept chatting. It was broadcasted nationwide. Okay, so we have locally free sheaves. Ah, okay. Now, maybe I'm going to skip some material right now so that we can get on with the where we want to get to by the end of today. Let me say quickly, example PN. PN, so I defined for you this, I'm going to define O of 1 again in another way. So, but the point is that in this case, any sorry, I want to give this example a little later. So first I want to make the connection between divisors and line bundles. Line bundles, so this invertible sheaves I will sometimes also call line bundles. Because traditionally that's what they are. Over complex numbers, you can define line bundles, which are vectored bundles of dimension 1, and then in the abstract setting, they turn into invertible sheaves. So if I have divisors and line bundles, if I have a divisor D, let's say it's given in Cartier form, so it's corresponding to some open cover UI and defining equation on each FI, then the line bundle corresponding to D on UI, is OX. Well, I guess I can just say, to give you the line bundle, I need to define it on. OX is true. Restricted to UI is OX restricted to UI times FI. Now, in some books you'll see FI inverse. I'll follow Hartshorne, who uses FI inverse. So I told you this has to be locally free of rank 1, so it's OX times something, and FI inverse is a generator. So that's the line bundle, and the point is this map, divisors to line bundles, which associates D to LFD, is essentially a bijection. position, map D to L of T is bijection to n divisors and line bundles. And I'll leave the proof for your imagination. It's pretty easy to see how that goes. If I give you the line bundle, you see locally it's defined anyway as locally free of rank 1, so it's got a generator. I use the inverse of the generator to define the divisor on the open set. Okay, so it's clear this map can go the other way. Now we need one construction given two line bundles, L1 and L2, you can form the tensor product, a new line bundle, L1 tensor L2, and it's still a line bundle because L1 tensor L2 will be locally free OX tensor OX module of rank 1, but since OX tensor OX is OX, this is still a locally free OX it's locally an OX module of rank 1. Okay, so in other words, at each point, L1 on U is OX of U times F1, and L2 on U is OX of U times F2, then L1 tensor L2 on U will be OX U F1 F2. Okay, so it's got a tensor structure. And there are also duals. Also, L1 inverse is the dual. It's a line bundle just defined as HOM. Oh, this is a bad one, I keep forgetting. So one can define the dual line bundle. It's so on each U, again, it's the homomorphisms from L of U to OX of U. And again, because L is free of rank 1, that's again, that dual is also a free of rank 1. Okay, you just need to find what the generator goes to. Okay, so you have those things. And using that, then we have the following proposition. Following property that L of this map is, in fact, now I've defined a multiplication here and I have addition here, so that map is a reflect, this map D to L of T respects those operations. L of D1 minus D2 is L of D1 tensor L of D2 inverse. So in other words, that map, the map D to L of D, is not just a bijection, but it's a homomorphism. In fact, an isomorphism. Isomorphism, before I've introduced the equivalence relation, that is, from all divisors to all line bundles. And now the point is, I guess I have to be a little bit careful because I'm using an isomorphism here. I want to also say that maybe to be honest about this, we should insert here before we conclude it's an isomorphism, if D1 is equivalent, linearly equivalent to D2, then L of D1 is isomorphic to L of D2. Okay, these are all easy to prove from the definitions. But once you have that, you see that now you have an isomorphism between divisor classes and isomorphism classes of line bundles. One thing, by the way, in proving this, what you have to check is that if I have a principal divisor, the line bundle corresponding to a principal divisor is OX. So it corresponds to the identity here. So that's good, because in divisor classes also those things correspond to the identity. Okay. And the, now, okay. Now the example I was going to tell you here about PN. So now we have a notion of this group, whatever it is, of divisors modulo linear equivalence or line bundles modulo isomorphism. It's called the Picard group. So pick X is divisors modulo linear equivalence or equivalently isomorphism classes of line bundles. And I was going to just tell you the remark example that if X is PN, then pick, this pick is isomorphic to Z. And basically what it one shows is that up to linear equivalence, every divisor on PN is essentially a multiple of a hyperplane section. So this the generator 1, one goes to the generator here, which is the sheaf that I denoted O of 1. And it's the isomorphism class of the sheaf defined by a hyperplane section. So consider the divisor where one of the coordinates vanishes. According to this prescription, you can associate to that divisor a line bundle. And that line bundle is what we call O of 1. And it generates the Picard group. So every other line bundle is equivalent to O of N. Yeah. So the sheaf, what is the sheaf associated to a hyperplane section? Okay, so that means that a hyperplane section is defined by xi equals, let's say xi equals 0. Let's consider that hyperplane section. Okay, so then on any open set, the sheaf is going to be, the sheaf, what is it? I guess I'm going to look at any open set, it's going to be the ring of functions on that open set, regular functions, but I'm going to invert xi. So these are going to be functions that have a simple pole along xi, along that hypersurface. Okay? That's what it is. Geometrically? Well, you can't. It's an algebraic object. I don't know how more clearly it defined. Yeah. Sorry? Oh. Ah, so that's good. That's good they're saying it. So here's PN. So what is it? I'm looking at so at a point in PN corresponds to a line through CN plus 1, and it's that line. That's what you mean by tautological line bundle. That's O of 1. I actually, to tell you the truth, I don't know how much clearer that makes it, but I think basically it is an algebraic construction. No. No, it's elementary. Pardon? Yeah. Yeah. It's not a big deal. It's a very, like, I mean, you unwind the definitions, it's a statement about factoring polynomials, really. Yeah. Pardon? Yeah, that at the moment I'm assuming algebraically closed field. Okay, so now those are the preliminaries. So we have now, in the remaining time, let's talk about, No, it's okay. I'll get to that later. Okay, so now this is completely general now. So far we've been talking about line bundles on a variety. But on an abelian variety, there are some additional properties of line bundles on an abelian variety. So there's something called the theorem of the cube, which is sort of a fundamental theorem. And what it says is that if I have a line bundle, and that has, by the theorem of the cube, is not does not require abelian varieties. It's the general fact about projective or even complete varieties. If you have a line bundle on a product variety, a product of three varieties, such that its restriction to each pair of factors is trivial, then the whole thing has to be trivial. In other words, you have x cross y cross z, and its restriction to x cross y is trivial, and the restriction to y cross z is trivial, and the restriction to x cross z is trivial, then it's got to be trivial across the board. Restriction. So in other words, I have, let's say I have x cross y cross z, and inside here I fix some point, let's say x naught cross y cross z. So I have this sitting inside here, then I pull back the line bundle. I have a line bundle here, and I pull it back. Suppose that one is trivial. So essentially that's a restriction. Okay, so that's the theorem of the cube, but I think rather than going into that, I want to tell you the implications of that, which is the following. Okay, the theorem of the cube. And I may return to the theorem of the cube if we need it explicitly, but for now let's call it the theorem of the cube, implies the following result. So again, theorem of the cube is about line bundles on triple products of varieties. It is not specific to abelian varieties. But now, if you have one of the factors being an abelian variety, you have the following proposition. Okay, so X is any variety, and A is an abelian variety. And suppose I have map from X to A. Actually, I suppose I have three maps, F, G, and H. Then, for any line bundle L on A, as I just said, I have the pullback map. You see, whenever I have, I can pull back using F, G, and H. So we have the pullback or restriction, pullback. In some sense, it can pull back bundle. So, for example, F upper star L. So this is a line bundle on X whose on any open set looks like L on the image of U. Okay, so I can pull back a line bundle. So we have the pullback line bundle. Then the proposition says the following, that for the pullback line bundle, F plus G plus H L. So notice this thing makes sense because A is in a billion variety. Okay, I can add morphisms. This thing is not, as you might intuitively at first think, F star L plus G star L plus H star L. And in fact, maybe the theory of abelian varieties is more rich because it's not. It's not equal to that. There's a quadratic relation. This is isomorphic to F plus G star L. Actually, now I'm talking about line bundles, so tensor. F plus H star L tensor. G plus H star L tensor, F star L inverse tensor, G star L inverse tensor, H star L inverse. So there are actually six terms. Naively, you see, it still comes sort of like, pretty close to being F star L plus G star L plus H star, but it's not exactly. Because naively, you could think of this, L inverse is like minus L, and so here I have F plus G star minus F star, so it's like saying this is G star L. And then this one and this one gives you F star L, and this one gives you H star L. So it's sort of, but it's not quite. Okay. Pardon? Yeah, because the point is that you'll see right away. Actually, I'm not going to prove it. I'm going to apply it to multiplication by n. And then you'll see all these powers of line bundles coming in. And so the fact that there are more points of order n than just n is coming from this fact. It's going to come from this fact. The fact I'm going to write down is a consequence of this. And it's also, I guess, related to the fact that heights are not linear. You know, they're some power. Usually, they grow. Heights of points are defined, so if you were to define a height function on a set of points, you have to do it in terms of a line bundle. And the fact that line bundles behave this way means that height function, in the case of elliptic curves, for example, grows quadratically. In the case of a billion varieties, it will grow even faster. Okay. As I said, I'm not going to prove this, but I want to apply it right away. Implication for multiplication by n. So we're going to choose the following functions. So the proposition is the following. A is in a billion variety. And n is an integer, I guess we might as well assume bigger than or equal to 1. Then, and L is a line bundle on A. Then, we want to know what does multiplication by n do to L. Okay, so I have multiplication by n is a map from A to A, and if I pull back L using multiplication by n, what does it do? Okay, the answer is that it's isomorphic to L to the power n squared plus n over 2. So this is tensor power. In other words, like tensor L with itself, n squared plus n over 2. Tensor with, this is L. Tensor with minus 1 star L to the power n squared minus n over 2. Here minus 1, you see, is a map also. It takes P to minus P. So the pullback by minus 1 is called minus 1 star. This restriction, by the way, is not necessary. Any integer will do. But the point is, stare at this formula a little bit. Multiplication by n, if you pull back a line bundle, you get two different kinds of line bundles. There's a minus 1 missing here. There's a power of L inverse, is that right? No, it's okay. That's right. There's a power of L and there's a power of some line bundle that you get by pulling it back via minus 1. Okay. Now the proof is this just by induction. Proof is by induction using previous result. So the right choices of this map, this result here where I had F plus G plus H, the right choices are as follows. F equals N plus 1, G equals 1, and H equals minus 1. So if you apply FG and H with that and to that theorem there, what you will get is that N plus 1 star L is N plus 2 star L tensor N star L tensor N plus 1 star L inverse tensor L inverse tensor with minus 1 star L inverse. Okay, I just applied this with these choices. I just wrote down what that says. then you apply the induction hypothesis on this part. You see, the point is this one. I can another way of the simple calculus of line bundles. This implies that n plus 2 star L. I can bring all of these over to the other side. I get n plus 1 star L tensor. This one, when I bring it to the other side, it becomes n plus 1 star L. That's this tensor n star L inverse tensor L tensor minus 1 star L. And now you use, as I said, the induction, and then you'll get it. Okay. So now I claim that implies an interesting fact. Okay, consequence. Is that the map multiplication by n is surjective. And equivalently, kernel of n is finite, that is zero dimensional. So we'll deduce that as follows. No equations. So let L be an ample line bundle. Oh, I didn't tell you what ample means. Sorry. Okay, that's sorry. Let me tell you what ample means. So line bundles are used for many things. First, maybe their first application is to projective embeddings. You have a line bundle, you can try to use it to embed your variety into projective space in the following way. You see, suppose on an open set U, we have sections FR that generate L of U. Then we can map U to projector space by sending a point X to the class of F1 of X, so point X naught, let's say, X naught, F2 of X naught, FR of X naught. Class meaning because projective space implies an equivalence relation. So if you take a bunch of functions that are defined on U, then you can try to make a map that evaluates those functions at a given point. So the point is that if you've got enough of such functions, then this will be an injection. In fact, it will be an immersion. And enough functions means you need to know various things. For example, that not all the FIs will vanish at a given point, X naught. So when that happens, you say that in order for this to give you an embedding, you need the following property, that the FIs generate the group of sections. For this even to be well defined, and then an embedding, the FI need to satisfy some conditions. As I said, one of them, to be well defined, it should be that they don't all simultaneously vanish, otherwise it won't define a point in projective space. But you need more than that to define the embedding, and the condition that makes it all work is if F1 to FR generate L of U, then this is sufficient. More generally, if you say that L is ample, I guess what I'm defining is L is very ample, if it is generated by its global section, if it is generated by global sections. So here I said on an open set U, if the FIs have certain properties, then I can define an embedding of that open set into PN. But if I want to embed the whole variety X into PN, I need this thing to work for every U. So the correct notion is the notion of very ample. That means that there are enough functions, there's an ample, a very ample supply of functions in from coming from this line bundle, which can be used to do the embedding. And the correct notion is that there, it be generated by global section. In other words, for every U, L of U, there are functions, F1 to FR, defined globally, such that for every U, their restriction generate L of U. Okay? And then ample means L is ample if L tensor N is very ample for some N. In the case of curves, you see, sometimes you do this kind of thing. When a divisor doesn't work for you, you take multiples of that divisor. Sufficiently large multiple, ND. Well, Ken has a question. Yeah. So in some sense, I don't really care. I just want some projective embedding. Yeah. So if R is the number, then yes. So just as with divisors on curves, sometimes a particular divisor isn't good for you, but you take a high multiple of it. In the Riemann-Roch theorem, on curves, when you try to construct functions that have a certain kind of divisor, if you give me a specific divisor, it's hard to construct, could be hard to construct that function. But if you took a sufficiently high multiple, then the Riemann-Roch theorem simplifies and gives you the dimension of the space of functions that have polar that have divisor supported on that multiple. So that's exactly what we're doing here. If L itself doesn't have enough functions, then some power of it might. So that's why this notion is important. Ample means some power of it is very ample. Okay, so now I can go back to this proof. Let A be an ample. Do I want ample or very ample here? Actually, it doesn't matter. Let A be an ample. Let's say very ample, but it doesn't really matter. Let L be a very ample line bundle on A. How do you know such a thing exists? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. More than complete. An abelian variety has a projective embedding, and so I can pull back the hyperplane section, O1. That would be very ample. Any abelian variety has a projective embedding. Pardon? No. I just the theorem of Lefschetz. So. You're using actually the group structure too. Yeah, it's a nice, rather nice theorem involving over complex numbers involving theta functions, which uses the group structure a lot. Okay, so but anyway, there exist very ample line bundles on A, and this is telling us this theorem that has now gone is telling us that then N star L is L to the power n squared plus n over 2 tensor minus 1 star L to the n squared minus n over 2. And I'm taking powers of an ample, very ample line bundle. It stays very ample. So this is still very ample. I'm taking positive powers. This is also very ample. Because as soon as n is bigger than or equal to 2, n equals 1, I leave as an exercise. Okay, so I can assume n is at least 2. So as soon as n is at least 2, this is also positive, so this is also very ample. Minus 1 is an automorphism. The map minus 1 from A to A is an automorphism. So it'll pull back very ample bundles to very ample bundles. So, and then I'm multiplying together two very ample bundles, I still get very ample bundles. So I'm assuming a little bit of calculus of very ample bundles. If you multiply two very ample bundles, you get a very ample bundle. If you pull back a very ample bundle by an automorphism, you still get a very ample bundle. All these things can be verified. So the point is, this is therefore, n star L is very ample. But then, if the kernel, you see, if this thing is not surjective, or if the kernel is finite, is positive dimensional, by the way, those two are equivalent, because this is a homomorphism, so the dimension of the kernel plus the dimension of the image will be equal to the dimension of A. So whether it's surjective or kernel being positive is being zero dimensional, they're equivalent. So if the kernel is positive dimensional, then I can take this very ample bundle and restrict it to the kernel. Okay, then n star L restricted to the kernel of multiplication by n, it still has to be very ample. Let me say it like this. I can consider that restriction. Now, a very ample bundle restricted to a subvariety still has to be very ample, because you saw the definition is about generating sections on every open set. So even if I were to restrict to a subvariety, it's got to still have that generating property. So if this were some positive dimensional variety, I don't care how I got it, it's some subvariety, when I restrict this thing, I still have to get something very ample. But of course I can't, because on this thing the bundle is trivial. That's a contradiction. This is trivial bundle. Contradiction. Compact. It's compact. It's zero dimensional, it's compact, it's a finite set.
Right, I'm fine with that, but I'm just wondering why would you get a contradiction if the kernel
of n is zero dimensional? In other words, why is it always a contradiction? So what is it? I'm trying to say that you see, the point is, at some points these firstly, what are we contradicting? So we're saying that if you have a very ample bundle, if you restrict to a positive dimensional variety, you still get something very ample. If I were to restrict to a zero dimensional variety, good question. Let's say I restrict to a point. So I have. Pardon? No, say that. Yes. The pullback is zero, yes. But wait a minute, I want to contradict the fact that it's positive dimensional. Which one? This one?
Yeah, because
it's not an
well.
No, I think it is. Well, look, certainly it's ample. If I start with these things being ample, it'll be ample. And so so that's the point. This is ample, may not be very ample. Okay, I may need to take a further power of it. And so what am I saying here? So if I have an ample thing, then even if I restrict to a finite set, you see that, what does it contradict? That if I have something ample, then I restrict it to a positive dimensional subvariety, it has to stay ample. But it may not be ample on a zero dimensional. I may need to take some power. In fact, maybe... No. You were going to say something?
I was saying that if the coefficient of n to the kernel is zero, then the pullback of n to the kernel is zero. But a zero pullback cannot be ample.
Yeah. No, that's correct. Yes. Yeah, no, that's the argument. But I think what he... Yes, L is ample, and then I'm pulling back by N. So I have N star L.
Yes.
And we verified that N star L is ample.
Yes.
Sheaf, yeah. Right. Pardon? Yeah, I think we're done. I just missed. Yeah. Okay. So, sorry, there's one small point here, but this is the argument that I want to leave with you, that this cannot be positive dimensional, because its restriction here is trivial, and on the other hand, it's supposed to be ample. Now, there's one point we have to figure out, but basically, I think we're done. Okay, let's stop there. Next time, I want to, unless people want me to go over any of this again, I want to go to what is this kernel as a finite group scheme. Okay. So,
when we were using these f, g, and h, so g plus h is 0.
Correct.
And what happens
so
here?
It's just the ox, so it's like tensoring with ox, so it's nothing.
Oh, okay.
So I have an ample set.
Thank you.
No, it's not an embedding on that. This is ample. I mean, certainly the conclusion that kernel n is zero-dimensional is correct. So the consequence is proved. Now the question is, how can you have an... Yeah, so there's no problem, actually. The question is, how can you have an ample... When you have an ample bundle, if you restrict it to any point, if you restrict it to a point, I guess the point is, does it separate points?